Okay, so now we come to the final, very final stage of this 37 Bodhipakkhadhammas. The last part is the Noble Eightfold Path, and the Noble Eightfold Path is really just it's almost like a summary of the 37 Bodhipakkhadhammas. So it's almost as if we are looking at them again, but now in a kind of summarized version. So coming to the very end, and I looked at this quite briefly. The Noble Eightfold Path is really a kind of a topic in its own right that we can go on for a whole 9 days just about the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's going to be quite a brief exposition of the factors here. There is a whole collected discourse, a whole collection of discourses on the Noble Eightfold Path is found in the Sanghita Nikaya, the collected discourses, the 45th chapter. And this is where this first sutta is from, or this only sutta rather, and it is the first sutta in that particular collection. So let's just turn to it and just get into it and see what happens. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There, the Buddha addressed the mendicants. "Mendicants, venerable sir," they replied, and the Buddha said this. I can perhaps point out that Sarvati was one of the places where the Buddha stayed the most. This is the capital city of the Kosalan kingdom, which was presided over by King Pasenadi of Kosala, and he was a very close disciple of the Buddha, and that may have been one of the reasons why the Buddha chose to stay there so much. And this monastery, a very famous monastery, Anathapindika's monastery, was given to the Buddha by this very wealthy merchant called Anathapindika. And if you go to this part of India to the present day, you can see the ancient ruins of this monastery. These ruins, they don't go all the way back to the time of the Buddha, but they are ruins for maybe a few hundred years after the Buddha's passing away. But the place is pretty certain, and you can see the outlines of the city there when you go there, the kind of big city walls. You get a feeling for the distance between the city and the monastery. And it's all quite nice. You get a fairly good feeling for what it would have been like to live there as a monastic at that time. Anyway, so the Buddha stayed there. He said to have stayed there for about 20 rains retreats in Sarvati. So it was a very important, the most important place, most important monastery for the Buddha at that time. So this is then the discourse that he gave. "Mendicants, ignorance precedes the attainment of unskillful qualities, with lack of conscience and prudence following along. An ignoramus, sunk in ignorance, gives rise to wrong view. Wrong view gives rise to wrong thought. Wrong thought gives rise to wrong speech. Wrong speech gives rise to wrong action. Wrong action gives rise to wrong livelihood. Wrong livelihood gives rise to wrong effort. Wrong effort gives rise to wrong mindfulness. And wrong mindfulness gives rise to wrong immersion or wrong samadhi." So this shows you the wrong Eightfold Path. So this is what we try to avoid. And then, of course, the next paragraph is the the opposite, which is the right Noble Eightfold Path. So it starts off with ignorance, and ignorance, the Pali word is avidya, ignorance is quite in many ways a literal description or literal translation, but really, avidya is more like delusion, a lack of seeing things clearly, a lack of understanding how the world works, having ideas that are contrary to how things actually are. And so it's not really ignorance in any ordinary... ignorance is part of it, but it goes much deeper than that. It goes to having wrong ideas about the world, distorted perception, distorted ideas, and not seeing things clearly. That's often what what comes out, what this really is about. And you can see here that ignorance is here considered the root problem, because if you have that ignorance or you have that delusion, you don't give rise to the very first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right view. So wrong view arises from that distortion of reality. And if you don't get to the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, well, then the whole path really collapses. Because as with so many of these other 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, it is a conditioned path. Each factor conditions the next one. So if your view is completely wrong, then you don't even get started. So ignorance is a delusion, is a problem. And it's a very deep problem, because the problem with delusion is that very often you don't know that you have it. Yeah, this is kind of delusion is blinding. It kind of blinds you. So delusion has this self-perpetuating tendency. You are deluded, and then you carry on being deluded, because delusion causes more delusion in the future, precisely because your outlook is so wrong. So it is a very problematic thing here. So one of the first insights people sometimes have on the path is this feeling, this understanding that they are deluded. You have some idea that there is a delusion going on in you. And this is already a very useful thing to be aware of. And this is, I think, something you find in the Dhammapada, I think it is, somewhere, that the person who knows that they are deluded, they are at least wise to that extent. But the person who doesn't know that they are deluded, well, they are really sunk in delusion, and there's no way that they can find, it's very hard to find a way out. So it's kind of, it's almost a bit frightening, because delusion is self-perpetuating, and it means that you are kind of stuck in many ways. And once you get that, if you have a little glimpse or insight into your own delusion, it can become a very powerful source again for the practice, because you understand how dangerous it is. And especially if you haven't got any good teachers around, like the Buddha, to show you the way, then of course you are really stuck, because there is no way out of that. And this is why the kind of the Buddha arising as the eye of the world is so important, because it gives you some chance to understand your own delusion and find your way out of these things. So delusion is a big problem, and this is kind of at the very the very kind of beginning here of all these problems. So it precedes the attainment of unskillful qualities, with lack of conscience and prudence following along. And these two words here, lack of conscience and lack of prudence, these are two reasonably important words in the Pali Suttas. These two words are hiri and otapa. And hiri is a word which means something like shame, perhaps. But not shame in a bad way, but shame in a more of a positive sense, like conscience. You feel kind of slightly unworthy of your act if you do something bad. And this is a good thing in Buddhism. If you feel that you have kind of, been a kind of a, almost like a bit of a traitor to yourself, you have let yourself down when you've done something bad, and it has to be bad. It can't be just some kind of thing that you feel shameful for because someone else says you it's bad or something like that. It has to be a truly bad act, and that is a positive thing here. It's something that upholds your morality to some extent, because you want to move away from that. So conscience or shame is actually a positive quality on the Buddhist path. It is said elsewhere that these two things, hiri and otapa, are kind of the things that uphold the world, that make the world a civilized place. Because if nobody had any shame or no otapa, I'll come back to that in a second, then the world would just collapse into immorality and problems and wars and what have you. So they're kind of the two qualities that uphold the world as a kind of civilized place where we can function together and work in collaboration and all of that. So when you have avidya, because you don't really understand things rightly, because you have an upside-down idea of the world, you may not even have any of that conscience. Conscience may be completely gone, because you just don't really realize that these things are bad, or these things shouldn't be done, or whatever it is. That is the conscience side of things. The other one, lack of prudence. Prudence here, otapa, is usually defined as not being afraid of the consequences of your actions, having no fear of what comes from your actions. And once we understand in a deep way the consequences of our actions, in one way that has to do with karma and what happens in future lives, but also it has to do with what happens to us right here and right now. How we feel about ourselves, how the consequences of just kind of letting yourself down and not being able to practice the path, or being censured by the wise, or whatever it is, all of these negative qualities that come along. And also the opposite, yeah, the idea that if you do good, then it has good consequences because of you just feel good about yourself or whatever it is. So this is the fear of the consequences, this is otapa here, called prudence by Bhantasiddhartha, which lack of conscience and prudence, I think, are nice translations. They're given slightly different slant to these ideas from what you normally hear, so they are very useful. A large part of the Buddhist teaching is precisely about otapa. It's about the, you know, understanding the good consequences of living well. So it is all understanding consequences is such an incredibly important part of the Buddhist teachings. The whole of the Buddhist teachings can be said to be about causality, conditionality. This is what kind of makes Buddhism, one of the things that makes Buddhism so unique, because in other teachings or other systems of thought, the conditionality is not good, doesn't go so deep. It doesn't go so deep because sometimes it talks about things that have an inherent essence, like the self or like God perhaps, something which is outside of caused phenomena. But in Buddhism, nothing is outside of caused phenomena. So everything lives in this nexus of conditions that push you in a certain direction. So sometimes it may feel that your character traits or whatever are quite solid. This is the way I am, this is the way things are, but actually that is never the case. And it's always important to, if you remember causality, you also have some inkling to the extent to which you actually are able to change yourself. Wherever there is some solid essence, well, you can't really change the solid essence, but if everything is caused, everything can be changed. And it's such a useful thing. If you get really depressed, for example, you know it is not permanent, it's going to change again. If you have some idea that you can't go further on the Buddhist path because these are inherent qualities and you can't change them, actually you can. Everything can be changed. And this is what is so one of those powerful things to remember, because it makes the spiritual path, the promise of what you can get out of this path, become so much greater as a consequence. It's very useful to remember the causality and the conditionality of the Buddhist path. And of course that comes out in things like dependent origination, for example. It shows you how the process of samsara is self-sustaining without any recourse to a permanent self and all of that. These qualities come along, and then based on these qualities, if you are ignorant, that gives rise to wrong view. You are deluded, and of course delusion almost by definition is wrong view. So you have a wrong idea of the way the world works. And as I mentioned yesterday in the Q&A, someone asked about this idea of wrong view, and it is twofold kind of wrong view. Actually, really twofold kind of right view. We come to that afterwards. The wrong view is really only onefold. It just means that you have wrong view. So let's just wait with that till we come to the idea of right view. But wrong view just means that you don't see things according to the way things actually are. So this is one of the nice things about, the things I always found so attractive about the Buddhist teachings, is that they are about aligning your outlook with the way things actually are. It's about seeing reality. It's not some kind of delusion, not some kind of idea of believing in things that aren't real because it may have some benefit even though they're not real. It actually is about seeing things as they actually are. Which is great, because it means that it is a very kind of modern way of thinking about the world. Because the modern way of thinking about the world is also to try to uncover reality. It is about the scientific project in many ways. It's very similar. It's similar in the sense that we try to uncover how the world actually works. And the Buddhist idea is similar. It's just a different area, a different field. We also try to uncover how things actually are. That is a very beautiful thing. It means that ideally there should be really no clash between the scientific outlook and the Buddhist outlook. They should be the same. If there is a clash, then we need to find out why, and we need to find some kind of resolution to that. So it is a very kind of, in a sense, it is a very realistic and very modern kind of way of thinking about the world. So wrong view is problematic precisely because it goes against how things actually are. So, and then once you have wrong view, then all kinds of bad consequences come because of that. So because you have wrong view, then you think in a distorted way. And another way of thinking about that is the idea of wrong aim, of wrong purpose. Yeah, sankapa, this word, which means like planning sometimes in the suttas. In other words, looking to the future, having wrong aims and wrong ideas about things. So wrong intention is quite nice. So you have wrong purpose in life. Your purpose is not to purify yourself and practice a spiritual path, but your purpose instead becomes all other kind of things that are really not all that valuable and all that useful. And of course, once you have wrong purpose, then all of these other things tend to arise as a consequence. So if your purpose in life is just to accumulate as much in the sensual realm as possible in terms of relationships and money or whatever it is, valuable things, if that is your true aim, then you're not going to be so concerned about morality. Morality often goes out the window because the craving and the desire is going to be stronger than your sense of morality in that case. So for that reason, you have wrong view of what matters, and then you don't have integrity in the way you live your life, because it doesn't really matter. Your priorities are already set beforehand. And then you have things like wrong speech coming out of that, and from wrong speech you have wrong action, and then wrong livelihood. And these are the three morality factors in the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. This is one of the only places the morality comes out. They're actually quite important because they're not found anywhere else. So let's just talk about these things a little bit, just to get some idea what these things actually mean. Speech morality, wrong speech, is fourfold, and right speech is also fourfold, or that's how it is often defined in the suttas anyway. It could no doubt be enlarged, perhaps. And the fourfold wrong speech is lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter. These are the four. Also, as always in Buddhism, they come in a descending order. Yeah, so the lying is the worst one, divisive speech the second worst one, harsh speech the third, and at least bad one is idle chatter. So it's useful to remember the sequence there, so you kind of prioritize those things that are the most important. So lying is the worst one, and quite obvious why. Yeah, that must be the case. But it's also useful to remember that lying itself, these precepts themselves, they come in a vast variety of forms, and some of them are much worse than other ones. In Buddhism, the ultimate thing that decides whether something is moral or not, the root of morality, is what motivates you, what drives you, where are you coming from? And if you are coming from unwholesome qualities like greed or anger or delusion or confusion or whatever, then you know it's going to be immoral. But if you are coming from a degree of wisdom and compassion or whatever, then it is not necessarily bad. And a lot of the morality is somewhere in between there. So this is very useful to remember, because there are certain ways of lying that are far worse than other ones, depending on what you're trying to get out of that lying. If you're trying to hide something, or you are embarrassed about something, then it's not so good, because then it is coming from an unwholesome quality of delusion or greed. You want to be seen to be right or whatever. If it's coming because you want to exploit somebody, that's even worse. But if it is coming because in certain situations people are vulnerable and it might be very problematic if you tell the truth outright, then in certain cases lying is not going to be particularly bad. So be very careful, of course, when you come to lying, because sometimes you might deceive yourself into thinking that is a good thing. So be very careful. But I'm just saying that just to make it clear that lying is not a black and white thing. Either it's good or bad. It's a whole gray scale of things, from the most pure speech where there's, you're absolutely honest about things. And that is what we're trying to do. We're trying to be honest. We're trying to represent things as they actually are. That's kind of the ideal. And then there's a whole gray scale going down to the really dark things, where you lie to hurt other people or because of your own greed or whatever. And so that is a very useful thing to keep in mind. And the same is true of all of these precepts. And this is what makes Buddhist morality so incredibly flexible. It is not a black and white morality. It is a morality based on natural principles. If you hurt others, it's bad. If you don't, it's okay. If you're coming from defilements, it's bad. If you come from a pure mind, it's okay. It is not a set of rules that have been laid down by some kind of external authority. It is a certain principles that apply, that decide whether these things are moral or immoral. Same thing with divisive speech. Yeah, divisive speech is the second one. And the ideal way of speaking is speaking in a way that creates harmony, creates samagga. So you look to create harmony in the world. And you look to bring people together rather than dividing them. When you speak, you remember to focus perhaps on the good qualities in other people, to find reasonable excuses for why people behave in the wrong way, instead of kind of being negative and harsh in your judgment and saying that to others when perhaps there is no reason. But again, it doesn't mean that we should always be positive. It doesn't mean we should always say good things about other people. Sometimes it is necessary to warn if there is a danger somewhere. You have to have a fair warning that some people are dangerous. And then you do have to say what is actually going on. Otherwise, other people might be taken advantage of and all of these kind of things. So again, it is about time and place, doing it in the right way, knowing when you are driven by defilements and when you are driven by a desire to protect and to help others. This is kind of the thing here. But it's a very beautiful way. This is spoken about in the suttas. It is said to be that you are seeking, you are someone who delights in harmony, who speaks words connected with harmony, always seeking to create, kind of bring people together, rather than bring people apart. Very often we want to break people apart because we want to have certain friendships and there are some people we don't like and then we want to kind of break the bonds between those people and that kind of thing. That kind of thing is always very unpleasant and the sort of thing you want to avoid on the Buddhist path. So that is the idea of divisive speech, and it is the second worst kind of speech, and the third one is the harsh speech. So speaking in a way that is not gentle but harsh, that kind of is unpleasant to hear. And the Buddha says in this case that the right kind of speech in this case is a speech that is goes to the heart, that is dear to most people, that is happiness for the ear, yeah, ear happiness, quite literally. Kanna sukha means ear happiness. So very, again, very nice. Goes to the heart of people. Yeah, when you hear that kind of speech, you feel good. You feel happy about it. You don't feel that it kind of, it's kind of harsh and violent in a sense almost. One of the things about as I mentioned the other day, about speech is that speech can be a gift to the people around you if it is done in the right way. If it comes across as you are giving people, saying things that are useful, that are wise, that are spoken with a compassion towards the other person to help them or whatever, it can be always be a gift. And once you kind of recognize that speech can be a gift, there's almost endless possibilities of kind of giving gifts to the people around you. It's a very kind of, you open up the possibility of living in the right way, of being generous. You open up this thing to be almost unlimited once you bring these things into it. Then the last one of these is the sampapalapa. What does it sound like? Sampapalapa. It sounds like idle chatter, doesn't it? Sampapalapa. The word is like kind of fits really well with what it's actually supposed to mean. So sampa means something like rubbish, apparently. And palapa is like talking, yeah? So rubbish talking, quite literally. This is basically talking things that are meaningless, that have nothing to do with kind of with the things that are useful in the world, and just kind of blabbering on about all kind of nonsense. That is what that means. Instead, you try to say things that are meaningful. You try to say things not dragging on for too long, reasonably concise. We try to say things that are treasurable, to be treasured. And if you can say things that other people can treasure, yeah, like the word of the Buddha, you treasure some of these things, you remember them, and you carry them with you, and you take it out when you require them to kind of boost your spiritual path and all of these kind of things. That is the idea of speaking rightly in terms of talking the right way. It doesn't mean that we always kind of talk Dhamma. It doesn't mean that we always discuss dependent origination or whatever. Actually, sometimes that becomes sampapalapa. Yeah? Too much discussion of these things in the wrong way. We have already seen in the suttas how the Buddha is often friendly to people and he's kind and they have a nice conversation and these kind of things. So it doesn't mean we kind of become completely silly about this. It just means that there's a general tendency of how we speak. Okay, so that is the wrong kind of right speech or whatever, a kind of bit of both, and it gives you an idea. It's very nice to read these things in the suttas because they're very beautifully explained by the Buddha. If you want to read this, you have a look at something like the one sutta I always like to recommend people is the middle length sayings number 27, the shorter sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint. It is a sutta on the gradual training, and it gives you all the steps of the gradual training. It's really like an expansion of the Noble Eightfold Path, with everything kind of pointed out in detail, and it talks about the right speech and the right actions and all of these things in quite a bit of detail. So you find it in there if you want to have a look at it. It's very beautiful how the Buddha actually expresses these things. So then you have the right action, and or wrong action in this case. So wrong action is to kill or to mistreat other beings, any other beings. Everyone wants to be happy, so if you mistreat them, you are causing suffering, obviously, for other beings. So this is Panatipata Viramani, like the first precept of the five or the eight. And this is a very similar kind of thing. And it says in the suttas, it says that you lay aside sword and stick, danda, satta and danda. These are sword and stick in Pali. Danda is literally means stick and also means punishment. Yeah, just like in English, you give stick or whatever. It's like a punishment. So you put this aside and you abide with a mind of compassion and gentleness towards all living beings. And again, it gives you this idea that it's not just about not being violent and doing bad things. It's actually about having compassion. Compassion is really the root of this. And this, again, is very important. It's very interesting because once you understand that compassion and the good qualities of mind is what it really is about, it means that there might be certain kinds of killing that are not bad. Yeah, if we kill someone out of compassion or we help them to die or whatever, and you are using wisdom and compassion in that case, it is not necessarily bad because you're coming from a wholesome state of mind. But it is, if you kill someone who wants to live, don't kill me, please. I'm going to kill you anyway. That is bad, yeah? Because I don't like you, whatever, or you're in the way, or whatever. That is when it is bad. Again, it is all about motivation. And that is why, as Buddhists, you know, when the parliament is discussing things like voluntary assisted dying, voluntary assisted, I think that's what they call it now. When they discuss these things, it is not necessarily against the way we do things in Buddhism. It's not against Buddhist morality if it is done in the right way, with the right kind of things put into place so it doesn't get abused and all of that. That we're coming as a society, we're coming from compassion and understanding, trying to help people in difficult situations. It does not go against Buddhist values necessarily, depending a bit on how it is done. This again is very important. It means Buddhist morality is incredibly flexible. It is very flexible because it looks at the root causes of what is bad. It is bad when we hurt others, when we come from defilements. Otherwise, it is not bad. So we can kind of, we have this inbuilt flexibility. And so Buddhist morality is one of the kind of jewels of Buddhism, precisely because of that. Then we have the other part of right or wrong action is the idea of stealing, of course. Yeah, stealing is obviously bad. And the opposite of stealing is generosity, as I spoke about before, very important. And again, it comes in a wide variety of qualities, stealing, really bad stealing, and stealing which is not so bad, depending on how you do it. Then we have the third one, which is sexual immorality. And that is like taking advantage of people, yeah, in one way or another. That is what that is about. And that will vary perhaps a little bit with a society to society, depending on how we look at these things. But generally, all you need to do is ask yourself the question whether you're hurting somebody. If you're hurting somebody, it's usually bad. So that's really the simple way of deciding on these kind of all of these issues. And of course, for ideally, the highest kind of sexual morality, and it's called morality as well, is actually being celibate. And that is actually called morality. It's interesting in the sutras. It's called sila. In that case, it probably means more like habit, perhaps, than morality. But it gives you some idea of how far that can be taken. So all that gives you here the contrast between wrong and right action. Then we have perhaps one that is quite important for many of you, and that is the idea of wrong livelihood or right livelihood, because you've got to make a living. So what is there a right way of making a living and the wrong way? And there is. And of course, that is derived from the idea of right action. So the wrong livelihood would be one where we take advantage of other beings, or we have some detrimental impact on other beings. Often in the sutta, as it's often mentioned, a group of five ways of doing that, which is wrong. And these five ways are like trade in beings. Yeah, you're trading in beings so that they can get slaughtered somewhere or whatever it is. Trading in meat. Yeah, similar kind of way. I guess you are encouraging the slaughter of large amounts of animals if you trade in meat. Trade in weapons. So if you whatever that is, trade in alcohol. So being like a bartender probably not such a good idea if you want to kind of live fully according to the precepts. And the last one is trade in poisons. These are the five specifically mentioned in the suttas. But of course, all that can be expanded, it can be contracted, it will depend on the society that you're living in. But basically, the idea is not to live your livelihood in a way whereby you abuse or you living beings kind of suffer as a consequence of your livelihood, and also not having a livelihood whereby you encourage people to do stupid things, like, you know, selling alcohol and that sort of things, because basically just encouraging other people to be stupid, being a drug dealer, not such a good idea, yeah, and these kind of things, because you encourage silliness usually. So one of the interesting things about the Buddhist morality is that it is not just good to live well yourself, but it's good to encourage others as well to live well. This is part of the morality. So if you can encourage others, you're actually being more moral than if you just live morally yourself. Of course, you have to be careful. We have to know how to encourage, because sometimes we encourage in silly ways, and then they become even more opposed to being moral afterwards. Yeah. You are being very bad. Okay, you get very defensive and you become even worse afterwards. So you have to be wise in the way you encourage others to be moral. Otherwise it backfires. But interesting that that is part of it. We have the wrong effort. And the wrong effort then is effort that does not really go to purify your mind. Yeah, it is effort that goes into whatever else, but not into purifying your mind, which is the one, which is the right one. Wrong mindfulness, again, mindfulness that does not really lead you towards anything constructive in terms of spiritual qualities. And the last one is then the wrong immersion or wrong samadhi. It is interesting. What does actually wrong samadhi mean? The other ones are kind of, we can sort of understand what they mean. But wrong samadhi is a kind of slightly strange idea. What does it actually mean? One way to understand wrong samadhi is just the samadhi that has wrong view accompanying it. Right samadhi is often defined in the suttas as the immersion of the mind that is accompanied by the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So if you don't have right view, then of course that immersion is not accompanied by the other seven factors. And it means that when you come to samadhi, you're going to misinterpret the samadhi, you're going to understand it in the wrong way. And that is of course a big problem. This is part of the genius of the Buddha, is that even though the rest of society at that time in India would have interpreted samadhi in a certain way, as a union with Brahma or whatever it is, he kind of pulled back from that, and he realized this is just an interpretation. I want to understand this more deeply. How do I know it's union with Brahma? Well, what I know is that it has certain feelings associated with it, certain perceptions. But the idea that it's union with Brahma is just an interpretation. I need to find this out. So he kind of goes beyond that. And this is kind of the genius of the Buddha, this ability to see beyond what most people are not able to see beyond. So this is one way of thinking about wrong immersion or wrong samadhi, you know, a jhana state or a deep samadhi state combined with wrong view. But in this sequence here, I'm not sure if that is really quite satisfactory, because if you here we have one thing leading to the next one, starting with wrong view, leading all the way down, everything is wrong. It's hard to see how someone who lives so badly can actually attain samadhi. If you have wrong mindfulness, in the wrong way, you make everything is wrong. So it could be that in this case, it doesn't really refer to samadhi at all, or it refers to some kind of very basic focus on undistracted focus on something unwholesome, perhaps, or something like that. That it means wrong samadhi in a more kind of primitive sense than what I have been talking about. But either way, both of those definitions are acceptable, and the higher kind of wrong samadhi, and the one that we need to be most careful with, is the one where you have wrong view combined with actual samadhi, because that is where you tend to go wrong. And it is a big problem. It is a surprisingly big problem in the world, in the Buddhist world as well. Very often samadhi seems to be interpreted as the end of the path. It's a very common problem in the Buddhist world. And people have some kind of luminous or powerful experience that, this is it, this must be Nibbana. And very often I think it comes from not really having studied the suttas properly. It is very common in the Buddhist world, even among monastics, surprisingly enough, not to really study the suttas. And that leads, in the long run, it leads to the decline of Buddhism. Having got the suttas clearly, don't understand the word of the Buddha properly, eventually it's going to be very problematic. So and that is why you get all kinds of wrong views in the world, lots of them. And it's actually quite interesting to travel around the world and hear all of these views. It's astonishing the amount of views you find even within the Buddhist world. Somebody asked the other day about what it was like to travel to Asia and come from, have a different view to many people in traditional Buddhist countries. But actually, there's so many views in traditional Buddhist countries already. Sometimes I'm the conservative one. And these people in the Buddhist countries, they have some really kind of views that are really different. So it's not as simple as that, that kind of you come from outside and you are very different. Actually, everyone is already very different already. Sometimes the world of Buddhism is very scattered and divided into all kinds of things. You have to be very careful sometimes. This is why you have to come back to the gold standard, the one thing that is kind of the pillar which is there, and that is the word of the Buddha, because everything else is so unreliable. This is why these teachings are so important, and one of the reasons why they matter so much. Okay, so that is the wrong Eightfold Path, and that pretty much summarizes the right Eightfold Path as well, because obviously it's just the opposite of that. So now this time you have some degree of non-delusion, you're not so deluded, and because you are not so deluded, you have conscience and prudence. You have a bit of shame, you feel a bit bad about yourself when you do something bad, and you are prudent, you are careful, you understand that there are bad consequences of living in the wrong way. And that is that beginning of the path. You have some degree of understanding. And then when you hear the word of the Buddha, you think, yay, the word of the Buddha, wow, so beautiful, so wonderful. You don't just dismiss it and think, what a load of superstitious nonsense. You actually have some appreciation of profound spiritual teachings. There's a nice little story, story, I suppose, from after the Buddha's awakening. He meets this fellow, he's an Ajivaka disciple. And this Ajivaka disciple, what is his name again? Upaka, I think it's right, Upaka. Okay, I'm glad I have some people around here who really know the suttas better than I do sometimes. It's very handy. So Upakara, the Ajivaka disciple, and he meets this Upakara. He's one of the first people that Buddha meets after his awakening here. And the Upakara looks at the Buddha and says, "Wow, your faculties are so clear. Yeah, you must have. What have you experienced that your kind of your faculties are so clear and you kind of seem so together and so composed or whatever?" And then the, you know, who do you take as your teacher? Because in India, everyone has a teacher. So who is your teacher? And then the Buddha replies, "I have no teacher here. I am self-awakened. I am the supreme conqueror in the world." And then Upakara says, "Oh yeah," and he is a bit skeptical, yeah, and he kind of doesn't really kind of get this, and so he walks off in the wrong direction, yeah. And this he takes the umaga. Umaga is the wrong path, and the kind of the idea there is this idea of someone not being ready, someone being deluded, not having the understanding, the ability to see reality or see something good when it's in the very face. And so he walks off, and you never hear about Upaka ever again. He's probably lost to the Ajivaka path or whatever. And many people, we are often like that. Yeah? Often we don't see goodness, we don't see profundity when it's in our very face. And when I hear people say that, yeah, you know, the Buddha Gautama's sasana is on the way down, we don't know what's going to happen to it, I'm going to instead look for Buddha Maitreya, that's when I'm going to come back and I will be reborn with him, and then I'm going to be enlightened, but now I'm just going to chill, yeah? In this life, I'm going to relax, because we all know it's downhill. Please don't think like that. It's madness. Because you may very well be like Upaka, yeah? You see Buddha Maitreya, you say, "Oh yeah, whatever," and you walk off in a different direction. Because actually, it is not so easy sometimes to recognize spiritual qualities. Now that there is Buddhism in the world, there is a large institution, it's very easy to notice it, and it's more easy to take it seriously. But if you get an individual on the street coming up to you and says, "I'm enlightened," what are you going to say? You're probably going to dismiss them, right? If someone comes up and says, "Yeah, I'm the new Buddha," and you're going to say, "Get lost." And naturally so, because most people who say those kind of things, that they happen to be nuts, we know that. There's a vast number of people in the world who go around saying they are Jesus, they are Buddha, they are God, they are whatever. And all of them are well, yeah, basically all of them, they have no idea what they're talking about, and they're basically crazy, and they end up being locked up usually as a consequence. So it's hard to see here, yeah? Don't think that you're going to be able to recognize the next Buddha when the next Buddha comes around. You probably won't. Now is the opportunity. Now is your chance. Don't go for these pies in the sky that are so uncertain. It's a lack of gratitude, I think, to our present Buddha to think like that. He has given us, bequeathed us all these beautiful teachings. And the right attitude is actually to practice them properly here and now. That is the right way of thinking about these things. Then you hear the view of that Buddha, the eye of the world, yeah? And then that starts to give rise to right view in yourself as well, because you listen to the word of the Buddha. And you listen to that, and gradually your confidence increases. That is why you go to the suttas very often. Be careful with spending too much discussing things on the internet about these things, because the internet is so full of wacky views and all kinds of ideas. After a while, you start to doubt the bleeding obvious if you go too much on the internet. I think this is what the Buddha meant about doubt and paying attention to things that cause doubt, is to hang out too much with other people who have different views. After a while, those views start to make sense, and you start to lose your way a little bit. The suttas are no longer interesting, and gradually you can drift away from what is so positive simply by listening too much to other opinions. I'm not saying that we should kind of blot out other opinions, not at all, but you shouldn't kind of overdo it, because eventually you start just to get confused and you don't know what's going on, because it can be very confusing. So find a way that actually works reasonably well, then you are on the right track, and you reduce doubt rather than increasing it. Once you have right view, once you understand how the world works, which means understanding where happiness can be found and where it cannot be found, what is important in life and what is not, then of course you get the right aim. You get an aim which heads in that direction towards what is positive, towards happiness, towards all the good things in life. The aim gets right. Samma sankappa is there. And once your aim is right, then you start living according to that aim. You start living with kindness, you start living with generosity, you start living with all of these things, and you fulfill all these beautiful factors of morality on the Buddhist path. And then you purify your morality, and the morality gets purified to a certain point, and then you have to also look at the mind and purify your mental states. And this is what right effort is all about. We've seen this already, building up the good qualities, reducing the bad qualities. In a sense, the whole spiritual path can be summarized to that, building up the good qualities and making sure the bad qualities decline. That is almost all you need to know about the spiritual path. And then, as that purification of the mind happens gradually, and this is what we have been looking at now throughout this retreat, as the mind reaches a certain degree of purity, mindfulness starts to arise, mindfulness starts to become powerful. And at that point, meditation becomes possible. Prior to that, meditation is going to be a bit patchy, but at this point, meditation starts to really take off. Mindfulness is strong. Your ability to observe the breath starts to... You start to have that ability. You didn't really have it before, because your mind was too scattered, but now it comes together. And then, as you practice the satipatthanas, you purify your mind further of the last defilements of the mind, gradually, going deeper and deeper and deeper in your meditation practice. And eventually, one day, you make that big breakthrough. You come to the end of the world. You join Venerable Akaliko at his Vihara in Sydney. No, that's not what you do. That's the wrong end of... That's maybe a good end of the world, but not the right one in this context. You come to the end of the world, the jhana stage, where the whole sensual world comes to an end, and you enter a deep state of samadhi. And when you do that, your outlook of what is right and wrong changes dramatically, and you keep on doing that, keep on doing it again and again, taking it deeper and deeper, until the mind is so powerful that one day everything just bang, gets blown away, and you have the deepest possible insight into the nature of reality, and you understand what the Buddha was talking about. You understand all of these things. You understand about rebirth, you understand about defilements, you understand about where happiness is to be found, and you know through directly through your own experience that rebirth has come to an end. You know that. If you don't know that rebirth has come to an end, you're not at the end of the path yet. And this is how the path works. And what is interesting about that path, if you look back on the Noble Eightfold Path, it is all about purifying yourself gradually, starting with the coarser defilements, then the middling defilements, then the refined defilements. One thing after the other. It is a path of purification. And you know that word already, the path of purification, Visuddhimagga, but actually it is really the Noble Eightfold Path that is that path of purification. It's a gradual purifying of the mind until the mind is super bright, super pure, and all you have to do is you have to just turn it in the right direction. And that brightness of the mind is what enables seeing things in the right way. And this is a important point to keep in mind, because it gives you again a sense of direction, what this is all about, and it's important also to get these things in the right sequence, so you know what you are supposed to purify any particular time. Always start out with the coarser defilements. Start out with the big problems. Don't go to meditation and start to kind of, you know, watch the breath when you have lots of anger or whatever, because all you're doing is suppressing that anger, and then you end up with psychological problems instead of getting anywhere at all. You end up in more delusion rather than less delusion. This is when we take the path in the wrong way. It ends up getting worse. And sometimes people use meditation for in this kind of suppressive way, and it can have quite negative consequences because of that. You can get deluded, you can have all kind of psychosis happening. Sometimes people call them meditation retreats, and they have psychosis as a result of whatever they're doing, which they're not ready for that meditation practice. So remember, get the right sequence. The right sequence is about starting with the coarse defilements, asking what your main problems are, your actions, your speech. Then go to the middling defilements. What are your thoughts like? Try to straighten out your thoughts a little bit. Have a bit more compassion and metta in this world. And then, once the thoughts get straightened out, then go to the really refined defilements of the mind, the things that can be overcome through meditation practice. If you're interested in a sutta that describes that process, there's one in the Anguttara 3, Anguttara 3 is 100, which is called the Earth Remover, I think, that sutta. And it is about how gold is refined in stages. And in the same way that gold is refined in stages by taking out the coarse defilements first, in the same way the mind is also refined in stages in exactly the same way. It's interesting how the mind is compared to gold, isn't it? Because the mind is the most valuable thing in the whole world. Refined, just as gold doesn't shine and isn't bright when it's full of defilements. And the same thing is true for the mind. But when you take out the defilements of the mind, it becomes like gold. It becomes this shining, luminous thing that leads to enormous happiness for yourself and also by extension for the people around you. This is where the real happiness is. This comparison to gold is quite nice. Of course, gold is only gives a tiny bit of happiness, if anything at all, but it's still considered very precious in human society. But the mind is the ultimate giver of happiness when it's purified in the right way. And that is what the Noble Eightfold Path is all about. So think about the Noble Eightfold Path as the Visuddhi Magga, the real Visuddhi Magga. The other Visuddhi Magga is kind of nice. Yeah, there's many nice things in the other Visuddhi Magga. I haven't even read it from cover to cover. There are some things in there that are a bit suspicious. But this is the real Visuddhi Magga, the Noble Eightfold Path. So that is the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, the 37 aids to awakening for you. And just to remind you, what we were talking about at the very beginning, the Buddha is saying that this is his teachings. Yeah, these are the things that we need to remember for the future, to carry on from generation to generation, from country to country, from culture to culture, and carry it on in the world. These are the things that matter, because these are the practical application of the Buddhist path, and this is how we get those results. And in the end, it is getting the results on the path that is going to carry Buddhism forward into the future. If we don't have any Aryas, we don't have any noble ones, we don't have anyone who actually sees into these teachings properly, then the path is eventually going to die out, because it just gets to be ink on paper. And ink on paper is never as inspiring as the real results on the path and seeing people who practice these things. So to keep it alive, it is so important that we still have these Aryas in the world. So the Holy Grail is the practice of the Dhamma, not just the study and reading about it and intellectual exercises, but the practice. That is what really matters. So just to maybe add a couple of words on the very end, you may think that I've talked too much on this retreat. So much information, how can I remember even a fraction of it? Yeah, I can't even remember it myself. I have no idea what I said at the beginning of this retreat. Yeah, it's just all a blur after all these days, a big blur. So how can we kind of distill this into something useful that we can use in our everyday life? Because now we have pretty much come to an end, and you're all going to go back home. Then the challenge is always how to use this in a way that is possible, that is actually works in daily life. So you need to simplify things a lot. The one thing that you really need to look at, the only thing you really need to remember in your daily life, is only one thing really. So you can summarize almost this entire path to one word. That one word, if you know that the path is a path of purification, that one word is kindness. Yeah, so if you can be kind in your ordinary life consistently, and by kindness here I'm talking about kindness in the profound Buddhist way, including body, speech and mind, including both avoiding the bad and doing the good, if you can do that consistently, and by consistently I mean as consistently as possible, ideally from moment to moment, but that is often asking too much, then you're going to go a very, very long way on this path, because you're going to ready your mind, prepare it for the meditation practice, and then when you come back to meditate, and it doesn't even matter, you don't have to meditate that much during the year, it's good to meditate a little bit, because it reminds you of the habit of letting go and allowing things to be and all of these things, but you don't need to meditate that much. It is not meditation that supports more meditation, it is actually these other things. The sila is what really supports the meditation in the long run. So put the main emphasis on that, and if you put the main emphasis on that, then when you next time you go on a retreat retreat, wherever that is, hopefully you will find that you have made some progress as a consequence. So remember, if there's only one word, if you can only remember one word, remember the word kindness. But that's hard enough. Yeah, to remember one word. Can't remember one word. Maybe, maybe not. Sometimes we forget even the one word because we get so busy, we get so scattered. So the other thing that is important to do, just to enable you to remember that one word, is to get regular Dhamma input, to remember what the path is, to remind yourself of these good qualities. So whenever you feel that, you know, you're losing your way a little bit, or you're feeling that you need some more instructions, or you just need to be inspired a little bit, come back to the suttas, come back to Dhamma talks about the suttas, come back to, if you enjoy reading the suttas, read them, just to inspire you, get you back on track, to remind you of that one word, kindness. Yeah, because we need to be reminded, everyone needs to be reminded, we need to be conditioned and brainwashed in the right direction. And the second benefit of reading the suttas or listening to talks about the suttas is that it keeps on straightening out your view. Yeah, and the more straight your view is, this is the other factor that supports the meditation practice, the more you straighten out that view, the more your view aligns with the view of the Buddha, the more it aligns with the way the world actually is, the more powerful will be your ability to let go and to abandon things that are not useful on the path. Those two things to come together, kindness and right view, then the source, the cause, the basis for meditation is in place. So that is really all you have to do. Yeah, be kind and allow yourself to be inspired by the Dhamma on a regular basis. And if you do that, then you are doing what needs to be done to go a long, long way on this path. So that's the end of the retreat. Actually, we've got 1 minute left. this is really it. So I would just like to finish off by thanking everyone who has done such a wonderful job, and especially those who have looked after this retreat, Bianca, who is always organizing these things so well, and the caretakers who look after the center, all the people in the background who work on this all the time, people like Lehar and Burr, she's not here this time, but all of these people who do so much work in making these things possible. And of course to every one of you who have come on this retreat, because it is nice to support each other in this way, and it's a wonderful thing that we can do that. And also Venerable Akaliko, my mate in the holy life, and very nice for him, he looks after me really well. Yeah, I just sit down, I go back, and the breakfast just appears on my plate. Yeah, this is courtesy of Venerable Akaliko and some of the other people around. So what a wonderful thing that is. And also thanks to the bhikkhunis and nuns for coming along. It's nice to have a good sangha, both male and female. We should use this once because we are in Perth. We're one of the few places in the world that have a really strong both bhikkhu sangha and bhikkhuni sangha. We should kind of use that to kind of to showcase it and to be around and to have that fourfold assembly. Guess what we have now? We have the fourfold assembly. Yeah, so we have exactly the thing that the Buddha said that we should have. Good luck, all of you. I wish you all the best for your practice. May you all be happy and well. Okay, so now let us just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha one more time. Is there going to be a picture, Ananda? Yeah. Yes. Is it going to be here?
We are putting our back to the Buddha statue.
Yeah.
This
way, over here. Yeah. Okay, so for those of you who would like to stay behind, we will have a picture afterwards. You are not obliged. If you don't want to be in the picture, you certainly don't have to, but it's very nice to have as many people as possible. So if you feel like it, it's great if you can take part. So let's just pay homage to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha first of all.
Yeah. Pasipano Bhagavato Sanghaya.